the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Let's go first to the world of AI, a world that has authors, academics, and many others up in arms. This week, Time magazine featured one of the architects of AI, Demis Hassabis, on the cover of its World Most Influential People edition. His story is an extraordinary one, as is the story of his main rival, Sam Altman, founder of OpenAI. Both of their journeys feature in a book written by our first guest, Parmi Olsen, author of Supremacy, AI, ChatGPT, and The Race That Will Change the World, which recently won the FT's Business Book of the Year. Parmi, we've a lot to get through here. AI is a very contentious area, and I know that you have concerns about so much power now being in the hands of just a few very wealthy people. But can I start by asking you about the two central characters you identify in the book, Demis Hassabis and Sam Altman?
Yeah, so they're both very similar and very different in some ways. But Demis, I think, doesn't get as much attention as he probably should. He's based in the UK and from North London. He was a chess champion at the age of 13, a prodigy who was obsessed with games and obsessed with AI from a very young age.
And he was homeschooled, Parmi, was he?
He was homeschooled, but that was because he was going to so many different chess tournaments. For a long time, his childhood just revolved completely around chess. He started playing when he was 4 years old, just played against his father and his uncle, and within a couple of games was beating them. He just had his
mind. By the age of four?
At four, he was already beating his father. So he was really, he has an incredible brain, and to the extent that even in adulthood, he would try and avoid alcohol because he thought his brain was so advanced and so important to the businesses that he was running that he didn't want to, you know, damage it in any way.
You tell a great story about how Demis, when he was 14 and a world-ranked chess player, resigned from a marathon chess match in the middle of the game to the shock of his Danish opponent because he came to the conclusion that chess was a waste of brain power and that he had bigger ambitions and wanted to solve bigger problems.
Yeah, and it's interesting that so much of that was a very important moment in developing this very mission-oriented approach that he had to running a business. He didn't want to just run a business to make money. He wanted to run a business to change the world. He believed that if he could build this AGI, that it would solve all sorts of really difficult problems that human beings haven't been able to figure out. He would often talk about using AI or AGI to cure cancer, find a cure for all manner of different diseases. Similarly, in the US, Sam Altman, different upbringing, grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, to a middle-class family, went to a private school, went to Stanford to study computer science, dropped out, started a company which failed. Actually, that was sort of similar to Demis. But he also eventually found himself in this place where he became fascinated by artificial intelligence and this idea of building AGI, somehow not just replicating what humans could do, but surpassing it. He firmly believed that was possible. And he also believed that he could create abundance. This is a word he used a lot, abundance of wealth. He could create trillions of dollars of new wealth and just elevate the well-being and financial situation for people on Earth. That was one of the things that he talked about a lot when he started OpenAI together with Elon Musk.
And comparing the two characters, Sam Altman seemed to have a much more conventional Silicon Valley route. After a while, didn't he? Networking among tech firms and becoming the boss of the famous Y Combinator Academy for startups in San Francisco. Is he a very different character from Demis Hassabis?
I would say in some ways, yes, but many ways, no. In many ways, yes, he is very different. Sam is very charismatic. The way he runs his business, the way he's run OpenAI and previous businesses, was very much that you could talk to him if you were a lower ranking engineer. It was a very flat structure. Very much framed himself as this kind of Yoda figure who, even though he'd only really run one other business and it had failed, he somehow created this framing for himself as being this very wise sage, a consummate networker. He was plugged in to anyone and everyone.
He wasn't perhaps as aloof as Demis.
Yes, you could. Aloof is perhaps a good word for it. I mean, when you meet Demis, he's very charming and a very friendly person. But in terms of the way he operates his business, you wouldn't have that same opportunity for FaceTime with him. It was a much more hierarchical structure.
So both men had big humanitarian visions, didn't they? Seeing AI as something that could help the world, such as cure cancer or reverse climate change or find alternative energy sources, that sort of thing. Not the typical broligarch that we usually associate with breakthrough tech companies. How did Elon Musk come to get involved in OpenAI?
Elon Musk got involved very early in this whole story. He was actually one of the original investors, one of the early investors in DeepMind. And at one point, he even tried to buy DeepMind using Tesla stock. And the founders of DeepMind said no. And eventually they sold their company to Google for $650 million. Elon made a nice bit of cash from that. But he also felt a little bit concerned because he could see how advanced DeepMind was in their effort to build AGI, how far they'd come. And that was one of the reasons he started talking to Sam Altman not long after that sale about starting their own research lab to also try and build AGI, because they saw themselves as a potential counterweight to Google suddenly having control of AGI. And so he and Sam Altman started OpenAI with this idea, we'll be the good guys because we won't be owned by a company like Google. We will be a nonprofit free from financial obligation. And in fact, they even put into their announcement about this new organization that if they saw someone else was getting closer to building AGI, they would put down their tools and they would collaborate because this was all for the good of humanity. It was very important that they, you know, that they had these principles and these structures in place.
So they wanted to be the good guys who saved humanity. But ultimately, both Demis Hassabis and Sam Altman signed deals indeed with big tech companies, which,
right,
as we know, can be notorious for hoovering up startup ideas for their own bottom line.
Absolutely.
Tell us about why they did that and why they chose those two particular big tech companies.
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is building AI is incredibly painfully expensive. And when Demis was getting to the point where he was getting phone calls, these other tech companies were calling his scientists to try and poach them with much bigger salaries. He realized just paying the salaries of the best people that he needed was going to be really, really difficult. And with OpenAI and Sam, you know, they had a lot of talent, but they needed computer servers, like really advanced AI chips from NVIDIA, which is a company that has profited massively off of the AI boom. The only people on Earth that had the kind of money they needed happened to be the largest companies in the world, big tech firms like Microsoft and Google. The other reason, I think, is there was this really starting to get these dynamics around getting there first, to get the glory. It was also one reason why they ended up making those compromises.
So is this the age-old story then of brilliant dreamers starting off with a vision for curing cancer and making wealth abundant, only to be snared then by giant corporations looking to make money through premium subscriptions or add-ons to their own advertising business?
Yeah, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head. And it's not the first time that kind of story has been told. Silicon Valley is full of people who have started companies aiming to make the world a better place. And then they experience something called mission drift, where they find themselves moving away from this utopian idealistic goal that they started out with because they need to pay their staff and they need to make money for their investors. You know, they need to make them sound. And so that's not so uncommon. But the reason why I think this matters so much in AI is that this is such transformative technology and it's being plugged into so many aspects of life. It's almost impossible to keep up with the way people are using it in education and in healthcare and in the media and in the creative arts and in banking. It really is just moving quite quickly and moving everywhere. And I think the incentives behind how this technology is being built and how those incentives and motivations have changed and who's really profiting and who is providing proper oversight is important for people to be aware of. And the very reason why I wrote the book was because I learned a few years ago that Demis had tried to break away from Google for a number of years because he was very concerned about Google having control of this technology. And I thought there's something really interesting going on here, that both Sam and Demis tried and failed to set up these governance structures that would provide oversight, like responsible oversight of this technology. Sam tried to be a nonprofit. Demis tried to break away and become a nonprofit, and neither of those efforts worked. And so I think that that's important for us to realize that actually we've got this technology, we're racing at it full speed, but we don't have the checks and balances in place to make sure that it's used safely. And even the people who were responsible for building it were worried about that from very early on.
In January, we all thought that this apparent hegemony between these companies you've identified, Google and Microsoft, had been turned upside down by the Chinese firm DeepSeek, which burst onto the scene with a much lower cost, lower energy model. But how do they and other tech companies feature in the AI race? Companies like Facebook parent Meta or Amazon or Apple?
Yeah, so I think for a long time it has really felt like a two-horse race between Google and OpenAI / Microsoft. But now we're starting to see something really, really interesting and really exciting. Other companies are pushing OpenAI. The name OpenAI is actually a terrible misnomer because OpenAI, the organization, is a very closed.
I think it was Elon Musk who insisted on that term, wasn't it? Didn't Elon Musk insist on the term OpenAI?
Yes, and he came up with the name. And one of the reasons he's suing OpenAI now is because he feels that Sam Altman and the company completely went back on that promise to be open and to share information about the models that they were working on.
Was he right?
And they've done. As much as I disagree with Elon Musk in so many different areas, on this point, I agree with him. He's absolutely right that the company went back on that. And that's a shame because you can't audit AI and make sure that it's safe and make sure that it's fair and make sure that it's secure and reliable if it's opaque and if it's hidden behind closed doors in the way that OpenAI has done. So as much as it may say, oh, we're building, they still say it today, we're building AI for the benefit of humanity. They're doing it secretly and they're doing it without working in tandem with third-party researchers, auditing groups. It's all, we just have to trust them, trust that they themselves are putting in, are checking that the models are safe and secure and fair. But really, after all these years of empty promises from Silicon Valley, I think there's a big question mark over whether we can trust someone like OpenAI to do those things.
There are lots of big questions that people regularly ask about AI, and you address most of them or all of them in the book, including questions of bias and deep fakes, but also things such as online AI companions, such as virtual girlfriends and boyfriends from companies like Replica or Character.ai. How concerned do you think we should be about all of these things?
When we think about how AI is going to transform jobs and transform industry, I think it's going to be the real transformation is going to be culture and relationships. And I've just seen so many examples and I've interviewed so many people who are developing emotional attachments to AI chatbots. And if you're hearing this kind of thing for the first time, that might sound totally crazy and like science fiction, but there are millions of people out there in the UK, in the United States and Asia, who have gravitated towards using these chatbots as friends and as romantic partners. And in fact, one of the most popular AI apps for consumers out there is something called Character AI. And it's very popular with teenagers. Teenagers and young people are its biggest user base. The thing that's really shocked everyone is that artificial intelligence, we thought that it would be like an encyclopedia, like this kind of super smart robot, when actually its weakness is in getting facts right. Sometimes it gets facts wrong, but its real strength is in mimicking compassion. And these bots can be incredibly good at listening to people.
Yeah, and I was looking at a research paper from Google DeepMind, actually, and the Oxford Internet Institute, saying that character AI in particular claims that it receives 20,000 queries per second, about a fifth of the estimated search volume served by Google, and that interactions with these companions last four times longer than the average time spent interacting with ChatGPT.
I hadn't heard that statistic, but that corroborates just what I've heard from speaking to people who use it.
You also raise the issue in the book of all of the energy and the resources. The electricity needed for AI will double by 2030, with some data centers using the equivalent power of over a million homes. Could any of the new entrants, like China's DeepSeek, for example, which uses a lot less power, change that trajectory?
I think so, and I hope so, that we don't need to open nuclear power plants and get them running just to try and power data centers, and that our electricity bills aren't necessarily going to go up because the demand for AI is so strong. And I think it's in the interest even of the big tech companies in Silicon Valley to figure this out. So I'm not as worried about that as I was maybe a year ago. I feel like there's a lot of incentives in place to try and solve that issue.
And for all the negatives we're talking about, Parmi, there are genuine societal advances too, aren't there? I mean, in the months since your book was published, Demis Hassabis jointly won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for DeepMind's breakthrough in predicting protein folding, which is a very complicated process that means we can now design more effective drugs and medicines. And both he and others are hopeful that AI could even help to cure cancer one day.
They are. And we've seen with protein folding that that sort of thing is possible. So I think there are certainly areas for hope. It's just a matter of getting the regulation in place to make sure that, you know, it's not overused and it isn't misused as well.
And finally, on that question of regulation, that has been a big topic, particularly here in Europe. Are there any signs that the push to regulate AI might be softening with, for example, Europe withdrawing the EU Liability Act? Could we be seeing, amid talks of transatlantic trade tension, for example, the tech companies maybe beating the regulators?
It's possible. I mean, I think the dynamics have changed just in the last couple of weeks with everything we've seen with this, with the chaos caused by tariffs. Even before that, we saw an interesting shift in tone, I think, from government leaders, both in the UK and in Europe, over the importance of regulating AI. There used to be a summit called the AI Safety Summit. It was held over 2 years. And then this year in Paris, they changed the name to the AI Action Summit. Mm. Donald Trump has shut down the AI Safety Institute. And so there seems to be a kind of shift in tone from let's make sure that we are regulating this technology safely towards let's make sure we're first, because there's a real, I think, concern about China closing the gap with the United States in terms of capability, which it absolutely is starting to do. These models that China is releasing, like DeepSeek, are just as capable as the models we're seeing coming out of Silicon Valley. And if they're not as capable, they're very, very, very close. They're within throwing distance. And even more infuriatingly for those companies, for the American companies, they're free. This is a strategy in China to actually accelerate innovation. So if you encourage your companies to share the blueprints of your work with each other, everybody is just going to innovate faster. That's the idea in China. It's very different in the United States, where it's, you know, people are free to just kind of keep everything proprietary and keep everything secret. And I think the approach that China is using is one reason why they have moved so quickly. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in the next couple of years.
Parmi Olsen, columnist with Bloomberg and author of Supremacy, AI, ChatGPT, and the Race That Will Change the World. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.